We'll hear argument now on number 89393, Harry P. Begier versus Internal Revenue Service. Mr. Winterhalter.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, good afternoon. The third case before the Court today involves whether a debtor's pre-bankruptcy payment alone from its general operating account for trust fund tax obligations excludes that property from a bankruptcy estate subject to avoidance as preferential transfers under Section 547. For the reasons which I shall present to this Court, I would respectfully present that such transfers are, in fact, avoidable. The petitioner, in this case, is the Court-appointed Chapter 11 bankruptcy trustee in the matter of American International Airways. The debtor was a commercial airline carrier that provided scheduled passenger and air cargo service throughout the eastern and central United States. As a carrier, the debtor had many employees and was required to pay wages to those employees and was further required to withhold taxes from those employees' wages. It was required to withhold individual income taxes, the employee share of Federal Insurance Corporation taxes, and was further required to retain certain excise taxes which it collected from the passengers' tickets. By the first quarter of 1984, the debtor had experienced financial difficulties in the payments of its debts. Similar to many companies in this type of situation, the debtor failed to file and pay its tax returns on a timely basis. The debtor funded only net payroll. The IRS imposed extraordinary remedies for the enforcement of these taxes. It issued a notice changing the debtor's tax filing requirements from a quarterly basis to a monthly basis. It also required the debtor to make deposits into a certain designated depository. The debtor followed these guidelines and on April 30th transferred two checks to the government, one out of the specially designated account and a second check in the amount of $734,797 from the debtor's general operating account. The debtor and the IRS agreed to specific application of these funds. Two further payments were made out of the general operating account just prior to the bankruptcy. One for $200,000, which was applied to 941 withholding taxes, and a second in the amount of $11,636, which was applied to federal unemployment taxes and also to Form 11 taxes for the year 1982.
All the payments you've described, Mr. Winterhalter, were within the preferential period?
That is correct, Your Honor. The debtor's financial difficulties continued, whereby on July 19, 1984, the debtor filed his petition under Chapter 11. Problems persisted, and a trustee was appointed 2 months later. During the administration of the bankruptcy proceeding, the trustee instituted this instant action, seeking to avoid the three transfers made out of the debtor's general operating account. Following a trial, the bankruptcy court ruled that the trustee was entitled to avoid $700,410. The district court affirmed. On subsequent appeal to the Third Circuit, the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit reversed the bankruptcy court and district court findings. The Third Circuit, relying principally on the dissenting opinion of the D.C. Circuit in Drapkin versus the District of Columbia, found the ability of the debtor to make the prepetition payment of withholding taxes, regardless of the source of those funds, impress those funds with trust characteristics, removing the property from the debtor's estate.
What particular funds was the Court of Appeals talking about?
Your Honor, I'm not certain I understand your question. The funds which the Court of Appeals was discussing were the funds that the debtor used to pay the Internal Revenue Service.
Simply money drawn on its general operating account.
That is correct. They were written on a regular check that the debtor would pay any other creditor. It is respectfully presented that the holding of the Third Circuit is incorrect and should be reversed. The Circuit's reasoning is wrong on four specific points. First, the Court relies on the wrong legislative history to support its contention that Congress intended to preclude the avoidability of tax withholding payments.
Well, what about the language of the statute?
My second point would be that the clear language of the statute...
You better start with that, hadn't you?
I would believe, Your Honor, that the clear language, the plain wording of the statute, expressly requires that for this trust to be created, the taxes must be withheld or collected. In this situation, we did not have that situation.
Well, what does it say? Doesn't the law say that these withheld taxes are to be held as a trust fund?
Yes, it does. Section 7501 of the Internal Revenue Code
Yes.
provides that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Justice White provides that any taxes which are collected and withheld shall be held in trust. The wording of the statute, the plain wording of the statute, expressly indicates that the fund, it expressly indicates, and is written in the past tense, that the funds must be collected and withheld. Mm-hmm. There must be some type of segregation. This segregation does not...
It doesn't really say that, does it? It says the amount of tax so collected or withheld shall be held to be a special fund in trust. It provides automatically by statute that whatever amount is withheld for these taxes is automatically in trust. Or the government. Isn't that what it says?
The statute says expressly that, Justice O'Connor. I would represent...
So why does it have to be segregated to comply with the statute?
I would represent to the court, as has this court on other occasions, that there must be a trust raise for a trust to be established. There must be something there. If here the government suggests that they need do nothing, that payment alone is a sufficient designation to establish this trust. But there is no trust existence.
You're not now saying that it has to be segregated. You're just saying it has to exist. That when somebody pays an employee $80 and fails to withhold the $10 or put that aside for the government, there's no $10 for the trust to attach to.
That is exactly correct.
Now, that would be different for a sales tax, I suppose. If you collect a sales tax... And it's provided that the sales tax shall be held in trust, you would actually get the sales tax, and that could be held in trust.
That is exactly correct.
But with the withholding of wages, there's nothing
there.
To identify. You
that
just paid him 80, you were supposed to put 10 aside, but there's no 10 that we know of that's an identifiable 10.
Well, obviously there was money, though, because they paid him.
Yes, there is money, but there is no...
The law says that amount's going to be held in trust, and the money was there to be held in trust.
Not necessarily.
Well, it was paid.
Yes, it was paid.
Well, Mr. Winterhall, let's go back to that second clause of 7501 that Justice O'Connor referred to. The amount of tax so collected or withheld shall be held to be... a special fund and trust for the United States. Now, certainly Congress can legislate in a way that says a particular fund shall be treated in a particular way, even though under the classic law of trust there might not be any res, can't it?
Yes, it can. But
Don't you think that might be what it intended here?
No, I do not believe it did. I believe when Congress enacted Section 7501, which was back in 1934, it had contemplating provided some protections for the government in the collection of their taxes. They have provided other statutes which expressly empower the government to enforce its collection efforts. Section 6672 would be an example.
Well, suppose what the company did in this case with respect to monies that were paid from the general account, drew one check to the general account, and then immediately, drew one check from the general account to the special account.
Yes.
Then a second check, special account, to the government. Does that create the trust?
Absolutely. I think there is the act of the segregation itself.
And you couldn't set it aside as a preference that putting it in the trust was a preference? I mean, how would that be any different from the argument you're making now?
Well, I think in the situation which you have raised in your hypothetical, there is the designation. There is the creation of the trust raise, which allows it to come into existence. It is oftentimes suggested that the normal business operates properly.
It's not a preference to create a trust raise?
No, I do not.
But it is a preference directly to pay the IRA?
Let me correct that statement.
That doesn't make sense.
I believe that it would be a preference to create a trust raise for any party. But I believe under Section 7501, Congress has enacted a provision which gives the IRS special treatment under certain circumstances, and that is when the trust money is properly withheld.
Mr. Winterhalter, it seems to me I don't understand why you say that there has to be a reason in order for a trust to be created. If the statute, as the Chief Justice pointed out, if it says it shall be created, the federal government can make it happen. I should think that the problem here is not whether it's created, but how you identify it. That when the government says in this statute that it'll be a special fund in trust, you don't know what the REIS is. You don't know whether it's the bank accounts or the corporation's real property or any of the other assets of the corporation. And therefore, when it comes to identifying something that is subject to this special privilege, you can't identify it, isn't it? It couldn't be created. It's that it's not identifiable later. Isn't that your point?
My point is, Justice Scalia, that there must be some act, some separation. It does not have to be the deposit into the designated account. It does not have to be the deposit into the approved tax depository in a normal business sense. But there must be something. For the trust to be created, there must be something to set aside. It can't just – it's not an abstract, as the government suggests in their brief. There must be the creation that the separation –
It could be created in the abstract, but you can't give it effect in the abstract. Unless you can identify a REIS, you can't identify the trust corpus.
I don't believe I disagree with that.
When must it be created? I'm not sure I understand your position on that. Supposing 30 days before bankruptcy, they have a $1,000 payroll and $200 withholding obligation. They have $1,200 in the bank, and they pay $1,000 to the employees and don't do anything with the $200 until after the bankruptcy. Or they pay the $200. Would that be a preference?
If they held the $200 in their general operating account?
Yes.
And then paid it directly to the government?
Yeah, a week later, but still within the preference period.
Presuming that the other elements of a preference have been satisfied, I would believe that would be a preference. I believe that's the situation here. We have funds being used which were in the account, but no connection being made between the $200 in your hypothetical and the $700,000 in this hypothetical, which would connect the monies collected with the trust being created.
Other than the fact that they did use the money to pay the government, that's not enough, of course.
That is correct.
What do they have to put it? You're saying they have to put it in a separate account before the preference period begins.
I'm not saying to create the segregation itself or to create the designation. It has to be placed in a separate account. Again, many businesses operate under a three bank account system. They have their general operating account, which they collect their revenues. They then have their payroll account and they have their tax account. They would collect revenues from the normal operation of their business, place those monies into their general operating account, use the general operating account to pay their normal expenses, which would include their payroll and their wages. And once they provide gross wages into the payroll account, they then in turn would transmit the requisite funds to satisfy the withholding tax obligations. Upon doing that, I think the 7501 would come into effect.
Well, what if the statute, this clause we've been talking about, said any paid amount of tax so collected or withheld shall become the property of the United States?
I still don't believe you have reached that threshold of identifying the trust REIS. There is the statute does not say.
But this statute would not. The statute I'm talking about says nothing about a trust. It simply says the money that was withheld shall become the property of the United States.
If there has been no withholding, Mr. Chief Justice, I do not believe that the trust. Well, instead of putting the property in trust, you're creating a statute which would, in effect, transfer title to the property directly to the government.
Yes.
Upon the operation of the statute. I'm not certain how that would work, Mr. Chief Justice. I would believe that if Congress specifically enacted that statute and expressly stated such in a statute, then, in fact, that would be controlling.
Well, I have the feeling that the statute Congress did enact is not far different from.
I would respectfully disagree with Your Honor.
Mr. Winterhalter, it's my understanding of trust law that if you declare yourself to be a trustee of a REIS which is not in existence at the time, but later declare the REIS, it is effective. That is, if I tell my nephew I am putting in trust
$500 for you, and in fact I don't. But several weeks later, I set aside the $500. I say, this is the trust corpus for my nephew. That's effective. So you can do it later, right?
I believe that Hornbook trust law would look to the intent of the trustee in that situation.
Well, that's right, but I can do it later. I don't have to do it at the moment that it's created.
Yes, that is
now,
correct.
Now, why isn't it, and it's also Hornbook trust law, as I understand it, that you can declare in trust a portion of a fungible account. So you can say $500 of this bank account is held in trust for my nephew.
Yes, you can.
Okay. Now, when you put those two principles together, why is it not the case that as soon as the corporation wrote out this check to the United States, it identified a portion of that bank account as being the trust corpus that was owed to the government before it was transmitted to the government?
You would be talking, my response to that would be, it would not be a trust because you would be transferring title to the funds to the government on that time.
I'm not using it as a check. I'm not using it for its conveyance purposes. I'm using it for its declaration of what is the corpus of the trust. As soon as you sign that check, you have effectively expressed your intention that this is indeed the portion that belongs to the United States.
What... In effect,
as opposed to my real estate. I agree with you. Before that, we have no idea what portion of the corporation's assets belong to the United States. We don't know there was a real estate or whatever, and I'm sure the government would use whatever was convenient at the time. But once the corporation signs that check, the corporation has acknowledged a particular corpus.
Mr. Justice Scalia, I would present to you that the trust which is required to be created in order for 7501 to be attached, to attach, this trust to be created, must relate to the funds collected from employees' wages. If these funds are dissipated, if the bank account goes down to zero, then you cannot take funds unrelated to the employees' wages and recreate them in a trust. Those funds will never be affected with the trust characteristics if, in fact, they came from funds which were not generated from employees' wages.
There's no, how do you identify? Look, the statute applies not only to funds collected, but also to funds withheld. There's no identifiable dollar withheld. When I pay you $80 and withhold 10 for federal income tax, what identifiable dollar is that? It's no identifiable dollar. It is money I have not paid you.
But this is...
So you have to rely on my declaration of a fund later, it seems to me.
I would respectfully disagree.
That's for sales tax, yes. When I get the tax, you say, that's it. That's what the trust attached to. But not for a withholding tax. The withholding tax never exists. There's no dollar it ever attaches to. It's just money I do not pay you.
The trust language, Mr. Justice Scalia, under 7501, does not suggest that the trust attaches to monies collected and which should have been collected. It only says that the trust attaches to monies which were collected or withheld.
The problem is...
But if we fund only net payroll, if the employer pays only net payroll while the employee takes the advantage of the tax credit, the employer does not pay it. He does not fund gross payroll. He does not withhold the monies.
He withholds... By the act of paying the employee only the net, I would think. Withhold means deduct.
Yes, I agree.
So he is with, if I hire you for $100 a week and your gross is 100 and your net is 80, when I pay you 80, I have by definition withheld 20, even though I don't have the 20.
That's correct. But Mr. Chief Justice, if you don't have the 20, then how can the trust attach to those funds?
You're looking for something that meets all the requirement of Bogart on trust. I agree that it can't. My view is that this statute does not require those formalities.
It cannot attach immediately, but I thought you conceded before that the REIS does not have to be in existence at the time. You can establish the REIS later. And why didn't that happen when the check was written, even using Bogart?
Because there's been no connection between the funds withheld from the employees and the trust funds paid to the government.
Doesn't have to be a connection.
I believe that there does.
The REIS was created later.
But you acknowledge that you can put it into a special account and that creates a trust without a preference. And I just don't see how that follows from your argument.
I would represent to Your Honor that if there is the designation If you go through the steps to establish the existence of
trust. But why isn't the payment to the government a designation?
Because
why is doing something directly less of a designation than doing it indirectly?
Because in the payment to the government, you are transferring title to the property. What the government wants to say is, allow us to be preferred over every other creditor. We should be preferred. We should have some loophole. If that is what Congress intended when it enacted the bankruptcy code, it should have expressly stated so. But it didn't state that. It stated that the IRS, that the government, was going to be subject to the preference laws. It was going to be subject to a trustee in bankruptcy or the debtor himself from avoiding payments to the government.
Well, the Congress set up a scheme whereby avoidance could be had for items that were property of the debtor. These monies weren't property of the debtor. They were the property of the United States. They're withheld, it doesn't belong to the debtor anymore.
I would respectfully disagree.
Well, that's the statutory scheme.
But there is no nexus between the funds collected and the monies paid to the government. In this case, there is absolutely no proof that the funds used to pay the federal government were those funds collected from the employees' wages.
There's no tracing problem here. Once the check is drawn, that solves that. They've set it aside.
At that time, they transfer title. They don't establish the trust. What you are enabling by such a ruling would be for the principals of the corporation to, in effect, avoid 6672, 100% penalty liability. You are, in effect, carving out an exception that does not exist in the statute, while it may have existed in the proposed Senate statute, does not exist in the statute as enacted to allow a debtor corporation to avoid 100% penalty payments, to allow the Internal Revenue Service to be preferred over other creditors. This Court stated in United States versus Whiting Pools that the government should be treated no differently, that it stated in United States versus Slodove that there must be a connection, there must be some nexus when discussing this trust. If the Court finds in favor of the government today, it would be reversing the principles established by this Court in those two cases. It would be obviating the need for the government to impose any tracing whatsoever. It would just say that the trust arises by operation of law without anything further. The legislative history, the statute itself, does not describe either way whether the government can or cannot avoid transfers of property. Several courts have attempted to interpret whether Congress intended, when enacting the bankruptcy code, to permit the government to do just this, whether a bankruptcy trustee can avoid a transfer to the government to a government authority if the property was properly withheld. Each of the courts have looked to the statute and said it's not clear and referred to the legislative history. The legislative history was, as this Court has recognized, was a long time in making. The statute involved 10 years of congressional debate.
This is the bankruptcy code, you're referring to.
That is correct. That is correct. That is correct. When the statute was enacted, the House originally proposed House Resolution 8200. The House resolution was approved by the House Judiciary Committee, voted out of committee, and a report was filed. The language in the report is the language referred by the Third Circuit in their opinion. The House bill was sent to the House floor, subject to several amendments, and passed. It was then sent to the Senate. The Senate at the time was considering their own legislation, Senate Bill 2266. Senate Bill 2266 would have specifically carved out an exception that the government desires today, that preference payments to the government are not avoidable. The Senate bill was approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee. What they did, though, is they tabled the bill, Senate 2266, put their language into House Resolution 8200, and sent it back to the House. Because of the lateness of the term, the two parties, the managers, the House leader and the Senate leaders, got together and, in lieu of a formal committee, came up with this new statute, came up with a hybrid which imputed parts of the Senate bill and parts of the House bill. This hybrid bill is reflected in the Conference Committee report, which is also attached to the legislative history. That language specifically references the fact that the provision in the Senate bill, which allowed the government to have the ability to avoid taxes, was specifically excluded. Senator DeConcini's statement stated that Section 547B2 of the House amendment adopts a provision contained in the House bill and rejects the alternative contained in the Senate amendment relating to the avoidance of preferential transfers, that is, the payment of a tax claim owing to a government unit. What, in effect, this says is that what the Senate proposed and what the government is proposing today was expressly not adopted.
Of course, Congress could have rejected that because it would have extended to state and local government units, too, the way you've expressed it, couldn't it?
That is correct. But what Congress did do in enacting the Bankruptcy Code in its final text, it provided under Section 106, which is in the Sovereign Immunity section, clear language that the government would be subject to the avoidance of preferential transfers. In this case, if the court adopts the position as espoused by the government, you would, in effect, be overruling what Congress had expressed in the legislative history.
Only as to the extent of trust funds, though. It wouldn't be as to all tax obligations, the corporate income tax, for example.
Yes, that is correct. There is a difference in those taxes, Mr. Justice Stevens. The problem, however, is that there was no express exclusion in the statute for the non-avoidability of even trust fund taxes. And certainly Congress was cognizant of that fact by the protection of those taxes in both Section 507, which is the priority section, and Section 523, which is the discharge section. What Congress said there is that we want to protect both taxes which were collected and which should have been collected.
On that basis, it wouldn't do you any good to segregate these funds that you've withheld.
Under the Section 507 or 523 analysis?
Well, I thought you said a while ago, if you actually segregated these withheld funds, they would not become property of the estate.
That is correct.
And there could be no avoidance.
That is correct.
Well, but the argument you've just made from that other provision of the law on the preference, I would think that would cover the withheld funds that are segregated also.
Mr. Justice White, under those sections, they clearly had contemplated taxes which should have been collected and which were not collected. In the final draft of the statute as enacted under 547, they did not include this type of reference, and in the legislative history, they equally did not include such a reference. Justice Marshall noted in the case in this court that under 6672, they do in fact recognize taxes which were collected or which should have been collected. Under 547 and 7501, they do not. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Winterhalter. Mr. Martin?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'd like to begin where Mr. Winterhalter left off. In fact, Congress did pass the House version of Section 547, the preference bill, H.R. 8200. It rejected the Senate version, which would have made all tax payments non-avoidable. It did that to reach corporate income taxes, unemployment taxes. It's plain that taxes held in trust and turned over to the government cannot be a preference. Every court has recognized that. The joint floor statements recognize that. So the question in this case is whether a trust was created and maybe whether a trust was dissipated. The petitioner has argued that no trust was ever created. He has not contended that one was created and somehow spent and rendered unavailable. His argument has been that there was no withheld taxes placed in a segregated account. In the first place, it's plain that taxes were withheld. At trial, IRS Forms 940, which detail the amounts of withholding, were placed into evidence. And there's roughly about $350,000 withheld each month of the relevant months in question. On the question of whether taxes...
Can I interrupt you right
yes.
there? Those forms prove that that's the amount that should have been
no.
set aside.
No, it's a statement of these were withheld. It's not
But where were they withheld? Were they, could you identify, were there actually funds there that were placed in a bank account?
There were not funds placed in a bank account. They were net wages, in other words.
I know, but when you have a, when you file a form that says gross wages X and net wages X minus the tax, that isn't proof that the amount withheld was actually withheld. It's just a proof they filed a piece of paper that said they were doing it.
The filing a piece of paper and they're identifying it in court, it's genuine, and the document
says
we did it. It says we withheld. It doesn't say we were required to withhold. It said we did withhold.
Well, withhold means simply not pay.
Exactly.
Well, okay.
That doesn't suggest the existence that they put it deposited money.
Not at all.
Just that they did not pay that.
I'm just saying, if you had an employer, not AIA, but another employer who paid gross wages, so there was no withholding in the first place, then we would have trouble finding a trust under 7501.
Oh,
when there is a withholding, that's my simple point. When there,
okay.
Right.
I still don't. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm stupid. They say they have enough money to pay net wages, and they file a return that says we've withheld the difference between net wages and gross wages. Would that be? But they actually didn't have any money. It's a no-asset business. It's a sales operation of some kind. And all the money they had available to them, they used to pay net wages. But they filed the return suggesting that we withheld this amount. We recognize an obligation to pay it when we get the money.
There has been a withholding in that case.
What has been withheld?
Well, they've had to pay less. They've had to pay less than they would have paid. They had to reduce. They cannot pay gross wages. In other words, if they only have enough money, they have to make payroll, and they have to deduct on the forms, at least, from the paycheck. A person's paycheck, the stub would say, withholding of $105. The government cannot go after that $105 with respect to that taxpayer. There's been that much of a withholding. Maybe the individual would have a claim for wages against its employer.
But there's no asset representing the amount withheld.
Well, that's right. On the books, They didn't have to borrow the money either. Perhaps they could borrow the money if you wanted to find an asset. Withholding is just a deduction from gross wages. That's all it means.
You just mean not paid.
Not paid is all I mean.
All right. So the trust consists of a liability. That's what you said.
That's basically right. And this is a liability that, if the law is followed, will be satisfied usually within about 3 to 5 days by a check to the IRS. It wasn't.
You're not suggesting that in the strict sense of trust law, the filing of a withholding return showing tax withheld creates any sort of a res, are you?
No. I'm saying under 7501, whenever a trust is created in the amount of tax withheld, the amount of tax withheld shall be held to be a special fund in trust for the United States. It's a statutory trust. The trust is created by operation of law. It's in the amount of not paid. It's in the amount of withheld.
Mr. Martin, I'm willing to concede that you can create a trust by law. You can just say by law there is a trust. But
right.
you know, you can't make black white by law. You can't pass a law that makes black white. And what you're trying to do is to enforce a trust. And that is an objective reality. You are trying to move on some corpus, and you can't decree the existence of a corpus by law.
And so we
have to find some corpus to identify for the legal consequences that you want to attach.
I agree.
Now, until the check was written, at least, that corpus could have been anything. It could have been the company's plant. It could have been any asset, whatever, of the company. I wouldn't know how to apply a trust law theory to that kind of a situation.
And we
you would apply it even before the check was written. You would say that somehow you would have a preference on the corporation's assets even before there was any identification.
Yes, I think that we would, wherever we found in the commingled accounts of the withholder the amount of tax withheld, that would be the trust.
We don't have to decide that.
But you don't have to decide that, fortunately. But let me just, you know, there's evidence that Congress thought that too in 1978. The joint floor statements addressed the question of commingled accounts and said that the IRS could use reasonable assumptions, with one such assumption being any amount remaining in commingled accounts is the IRS's money.
I assume that what you assert the federal government can do by using the device of trust law, you are willing to acknowledge that state governments can do as well.
Absolutely.
So a state government could say, henceforward, any taxes owed to the state shall be a trust, and they would acquire a preference under bankruptcy law. Can you think about that for a minute?
If they have a parallel system, sure. I mean, if a trust is created under law, under private instrument, mm-hmm. whatever it is, payments of trust funds cannot be preferences because they're not properties of the debtor. That's right. Let me go back to the question you asked about, okay, a trust has been created, but how do we know that the payments are payments of trust fund taxes? Well, we know in this case, because of the black letter law, that a trustee may designate any funds, its personal funds, its corporate funds, whatever it wants to, ask trust fund taxes or ask the trust property. If they've wrongfully dissipated the trust, they can restore it with any funds they want. So when they write a check that clears, as in this case, that's sufficient to identify the trust. And I think that's what Congress contemplated in the House report, which this Court has viewed as authoritative of Congress's intent in 1978, when it said in the House report, and this is at page 26 of our brief, that the payment of withholding taxes will not be a preference if they have been properly held for payment, as they will have been if the debtor is able to make the payments. So we think that Congress thinks that if the debtor is able to make the payments, if the tax withholder can make the payments, the check's clear, that no further connection is required. Now, there may be cases where trust fund taxes are not paid over, to file for bankruptcy when the IRS wants to identify the funds. In that type of case, we would be entitled to use reasonable assumptions. One of the assumptions is that any amounts remaining in commingled accounts are the taxes. Well, here we have more than that. We know that there were amounts remaining, the checks cleared, and we also have the identification of the payments as trust fund taxes by the trustee, in this case, AIA.
What other purpose is 7501 used for? I mean, it seems to me it might be possible to read the first sentence of 7501A as its whole purpose is simply to lay the basis for the second sentence. That is, the only reality that this fund has in the world is to enable the assessment, collection, and payment in the same manner as the taxes out of which it arose.
Well, that's not what Congress was doing in 34. Until 1934, this liability was just a tax debt and had to be treated as such. And Congress wanted to say, no, once the withholding has occurred, it's our money. There can be no higher secured interest, you know, if it's secured, creditors can't take the money. It's our money. You can use trust concepts to segregate and to collect. I think that's clear.
There was no withholding in 1934. That must have been added later, wasn't it?
Yeah, in 34, it dealt with the excise taxes only and said that money was held in trust. It was added, I think it was 39 or 40, whenever withholding began is when it was in 7501 was amended to apply to withholdings in addition to excise taxes. I think the last sentence of 7501A just means that that the IRS can use the notice and assessment and levy and lien provisions with respect to trust fund obligations if it wants to, and we have to in many cases. So just to summarize our position, we think a trust is created when there's a withholding, when net wages are paid. No segregation is required. We can require it under Section 7512 of the Code if there's been a poor performance by the employer, but we don't have to require a segregated account.
Mr. Martin, in the case of the special fund that is created, that is a separate earmarked bank account,
mm-hmm.
if the employer, coming upon hard times, decides to change his mind or its mind and takes that money back, is there some kind of criminal liability? Or?
Yes, yes. 6672 is the 100% penalty provision for every responsible officer, and I think there would be 100% liability there, and there's also a criminal penalty for willfully violating the trust fund obligations, and I think that would fall within that. It's I believe it's a misdemeanor punishable up to 1 year.
And but that special liability, that special criminal liability, doesn't apply if they're simply a failure to earmark funds that are in the general account, and those funds are then dissipated?
It could apply for willful.
If it's a trust in either event.
Right. No, it could apply in this type of case as well. If the IRS policy is to use the 100% civil penalty before it would use a criminal penalty, but there are criminal penalties for the failure to turn over the amount of withholdings to the IRS.
But is the gravamen of the offense the invasion of an identified trust corpus?
No, it's not.
In other words, it's just failure to withhold.
Failure to turn to deposit into the U.S. Treasury the amounts of withholding. There are no further questions.
Very well, Mr. Martin. Mr. Winterhalter, do you have rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor. The government suggested that the record before the bankruptcy court reflected that, in fact, deposits or tax payments were made and referred to Form 940 returns. Form 940 returns would reflect federal unemployment tax obligations. That is not at issue in this case. What is at issue in this case is 941 taxes, which would be reflected on the 941 returns. Government's exhibits number 11 and number 12, which were attached to the supplemental brief filed with the Third Circuit, clearly indicated that while the tax liability of the debtor corporation was identified, there were no tax deposits made during this time period. In addition, the record, the joint appendix, which has attached to it a copy of the record, clearly indicates when the Internal Revenue Service, Mr. Alan Zlatkin, the revenue officer, was being questioned at the trial, he clearly indicated.
Thank you, Mr. Winterhalter. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.